Hey there, my name is Gary Sims and this is Gary Explains. Now I'm sure you've had one of those days when you wake up in the morning and you're not sure really what you should do. You go out with the family, maybe take the dog for a walk, go for a picnic, go and visit some people, or should you stay at home and wash the car or fix that dripping tap? Well, I had a day like that recently and what I decided to do was to write an encryption algorithm. So if you want to find out more, please let me explain. Now, to write encryption algorithms professionally is quite a complicated thing. It involves lots of maths and analysis of the kind of things that you are doing. Way too many people through history have thought they've written an encryption algorithm and that it was unbreakable, and actually it was breakable. This really is something I wanted to do because it was an exercise to see what it meant to write an algorithm, actually at least to think about it and to see the kind of pitfalls they were. Really, it's a bit of fun to see what I could come up with. Okay, so let's just dive straight in. Okay, so let's get cracking and have a look at this. Introducing Ocean 2, that's a name I've picked for my new encryption method. Ocean 2 is a stream cipher, and we'll talk more about the different types of cipher there are in a minute. It uses three 128-bit linear feedback shift registers to generate a pseudo-random number sequence, and we'll talk in depth about that. And the LFSRs, the linear feedback shift registers, are initialized using a 256-bit hash of the key that you provide, the password, as you might say. And the actual final encryption is done using XOR. Now, let's just note a few things. Why did I make this video? Well, it is just an interesting project. It is a look at all the pitfalls that exist to making an encryption algorithm. And the thing is, anyone can create an algorithm that he himself cannot break. So as an amateur creator of these encryption algorithms, as someone who does it as a hobby, because I'm not an expert in mathematics and all of the different areas of statistics and so on that need to go into analyzing this, but it's good fun. But good cryptography is hard and there are lots of pitfalls. And Ocean 2 has never been scrutinized by mathematicians or cryptography experts. It's considered purely an amateur project, and of course it is provided as is. So do not use this thinking you're going to be able to encrypt something and then no one's ever going to be able to break it. That may not happen. It may be easy to break for all I know, but we'll talk about how it's made and see what you think. But you've been warned. Okay, so this is more of a fun idea, academic, amateur, bit of hobbyist stuff. This is not going to compete with the stuff that the professionals make. Okay, so first of all, let's look at the difference between stream ciphers and block ciphers. Ocean 2 is a stream cipher. So a stream cipher encrypts, normally using XOR, like Ocean 2, the next bit, you could say the next byte, of data with no relationship to what was encrypted before or after it. So think of like a head on a hard disk or a head on a videotape or an audio tape, a ticker tape, a paper tape from the old days. It knows what's in front of it. It's got the number 65 in front of it. It encrypts it and then it moves on to the next number. It doesn't know when it encrypts the next number. It doesn't care about how it encrypted the 65 or the 42 that's coming next. It just doesn't care. Whereas a block cipher works on a whole block at a time. And it's very context sensitive. So if you're using a 4x4 block, for example, then the bytes in that block could be swapped around. So you rearrange the order. Then substitutions could be made. So where you have the letter A, you could put the letter B. When you have the letter B, you could put the letter Z. You can make all those kind of substitutions. And then you can apply also things like XOR encryption. And you do that on the whole 4x4 block. You can swap the columns, you can swap the rows, you can do what you like. And then once that block has been encrypted, you then move on to the next block. And for really good encryption, something out of the first block you encrypted, some key, some kind of initialization vector, they call it, needs to be applied to the next block. And then you kind of chain those blocks together so that they are related in how they were encrypted. DES, IDEA, IDEA, RC5, AES are all examples of block ciphers. Now, we mentioned exclusive OR. Let's just do a quick refresher on this. I do have a whole video about exclusive OR called The Power of Exclusive OR. I recommend, of course, I do, that you should go and watch that. But exclusive OR is true if and only if its arguments differ. So, for example, when you have 0 and 0, then it's not true because they don't differ, so it's 0. When you have 1 and 1, they don't differ, so it's 0. However, it is true when you have a 0 and a 1 or a 1 and a 0. And this is an amazing operation, logical operation, that has some really amazing side effects, which I go into in that power of XOR video. But the great thing, as we can see here, is that if you have a 0, you don't know whether that came from 0, 0, 1, 1, because you both gives you 0. So you don't know which path you took to get there. And the same with 1 and 1. If you got 0 and a 1 or a 1 and a 0, you don't know how you got to there. So that's the power of why it works for encryption. You take these two inputs, you merge them into one, and you don't know what those two inputs necessarily were to get you to that that final result. Okay, now stream ciphers, to work, you need a really good pseudo-random sequence. And creating pseudo-random sequences is hard. And there's been lots of studies done over the years about how you can generate pseudo-random numbers. So what's the problem with it? Well, the first part, you need them to be random as possible. I mean, you could literally do 10101010100, and you could say, well, there you go, that's random, because if you measure up the numbers, that 50% of them are ones and 50% of them are zeros. So there you go, it's a toss of a coin. Or you could do 11001100100. But these are, of course, are easy enough to guess. It's very easy to spot the pattern. But if you looked at it from a kind of, you know, a tossing a coin point of view, you say, well, yeah, 50-50, that's random. You don't know whether it's going to come up one or zero. Of course you don't. You do, because you see the pattern. So a pseudo-random sequence has to be really, appear really random, and kind of doesn't, and resists against this pattern that you could find what were the next one thing. But at the same time, it needs to be pseudo-random, in that you can generate that sequence anytime you want. So if you start from a known set of conditions, which is called the seed, and we'll talk more about that in a minute, then you get the same sequence of numbers. And why you want that for encryption is that once you've encrypted it, that the other end, you want to decrypt it, decode it, and you do that by generating the same sequence of numbers based on the password, based on the key, based on the seed, so that you can then unravel the encryption that you've done the first time around. So it wants to look random while at the same time not being random, and that, of course, is quite hard. So a linear feedback shift register, LFSR, is a method of manipulating a number. In this case, it's a register, comes from the ideas of hardware, storing a number in a location, not in memory, but inside the circuit, inside the processor itself. And you shift it, which means you shift all the bits to the left. You could also shift them to the right. And then there's a gap that's created because you've kind of shuffled them all off. And there's a gap created when you move them all. And you can put back another bit, a new bit, inside of that gap that you created. And there are different ways of creating the bit that goes in. If you just put ones in there, for example, every time you shifted, you put a one in there, then in the end, it would all just be ones. You'd be shifting one off and it would be a one at the other end. But you can actually take certain bits in the existing list, in the existing ones and zeros that you've got, XOR them, that's what we talked about earlier, and the result of that, which could be because of a one, could be because of a zero, a 11001100, you don't know how you've got there, but the result, because of those other bits, you stick that in at the end. And it so happens, if you do that, you get this sequence of ones and zeros. You could divide it up into sequence of bytes, or of even bigger, 16 bits, whatever, and they start to be random numbers, and there's hard to see the pattern of how you got there. So let's start with the example of a 4-bit linear feedback shift register. If we start with 1111, and we'll number the bits left to right, so bit 1, 2, 3, 4. So in this case, it's still 1111, but we number them 1 to right. Now, here's the thing, these things called the taps, which is we're going to take 2 bits to feed the space that's been left. So if we XOR bits 3 and 4, so that would be this bit and this bit, then we can put that in the gap. So if we take 3 and 4, 1 and a 1 in XOR is a 0. So we shift to the right. So we've moved everything this direction to the right, which means there was then a gap created here, and we filled that gap with a 0, because 1 and 1 was XOR to 0. And then we can do it again. So now we can take the 2 bits. Well, they're still, here we go, 1 and 1, so it's still 0. So we shift everything to the right, and we stick another 0 in the end. Now, we'll notice the 1s are starting to pop off. We start with 4 of them, and they're starting to drop off here, off the end. And we can keep going. Remember, we're now at 0011. Well, if we OR bits 3 and 4, we're still going to get a 0. So now, suddenly, we've got 0, 0, 0, and a 1. Our last 1 from our little list is about to drop off. But now, if we XOR 0 and a 1, Well, now you get a 1. So now when it's dropped off, you now get a 1 put here at the end. So it wasn't just going to be zeros all the time. Suddenly a 1's popped in, and that's now going to get shifted to the right. And in fact, if you look at the whole list starting at 111, we got down to here, didn't we? 100. If you notice that, those 1's start to shift across, but eventually you get a 1 at the end with a 1 at the beginning, and then you get 11, and then so you can see here that you get all the different combinations. In fact, in the end, you get back to 111. And since this is 4 bits, you actually do get all 16 variations there. Notice there's not 0000. That's the one that doesn't appear in there, the one case that doesn't appear in there. But you end up, you start with 111, and you keep shifting and putting in this feedback into that gap, and you end up at 11. Now, obviously, this is a fairly trivial example. And if you were to create a random number sequence from this, what you do is you take the number that gets pushed off the end. So remember, we push to the right, and then that one there gets dropped off, then this one gets dropped off, then this one, and then a zero, and then you'd get this string 111000100111, and so on. So that's how you would then create this sequence of a random number. But it doesn't take much to spot that if you start with 111 and then you push out 111, well, if you manage to work out what the random number was, you can actually see where it came from, which means then you can initialize your own cracking method, your own hacking method, which starts at 111, and you know that the if you know what the taps are, 3 and 4, those two bits we were looking at, then you can start to create the same. It doesn't matter where you do it, 1011, 1011, remember it's backwards now, and you get the same sequence, so you can go back 4 steps and say, well, I know where we were 4 steps ago, and then you can work forward and work out what the next number is. So you've cracked the random sequence. You've cracked this sequence of numbers. Now, of course, that's easy with 4 bits, but it is harder with more bits, but there are still weaknesses. So even if the taps are unknown, and that's when I was talking about, you knew it was bits 3 and 4, if you are given the sufficient amount of data, you can actually come up with the LFSR that created. In fact, there is an algorithm that will create the shortest linear feedback shift register for any given binary output. And it's a well-known algorithm. You can look it up. It's a bit of mathematics, polynomials, and all that kind of stuff. But it does come up with it. So there are weaknesses. And we're trying to do encryption that you can actually guess the sequence that's coming out of a linear feedback shift register. So therefore, on its own, as a pure thing, if those numbers that come out of it are used in the encryption, then the encryption is broken somehow. For example, you happen to know the message that was sent. You've got cribs, you've got all the different things that they use for attacking cryptography, and you manage to find out the sequence that's coming out of the shift register, then you can initialize your own shift register, and then you can generate the same sequence, and then the encryption is wide open at that point, and you can read everything. So how do you overcome these weaknesses of linear feedback shift registers? Well, one method that was proposed by Jennings in the PhD thesis is to use multiplexed LFSRs. That means you use more than one. And you can, there's another type which is called the shrinking generators, and there's even self-shrinking generators. Now, in all of these cases, you want to try to change the output so that it's not just based on the single function of that LFSR. In the latter case, for example, if there are two LFSRs, the least significant bit, that's the bit that gets shifted off. If it's a 1, then the output of the second shift register, 2, is used. However, if the first random number sequence is a 0, then it says don't use shift register number 2, just discard it. And in fact, it loops round until you get a 1 coming out of the random of the linear feedback register number 1. So what this means is that the random number sequence that you're generating, you don't actually know the sequence of the ones and zeros because some of them are dropped. Some of them are discarded. Decimated is another word that's used. So the random sequence that's coming out is not necessarily what was the state of the LFSR. And therefore, if you don't know its state, you can't recreate it yourself. So here you need 2 of them. And what you do is use 1 to decimate, to shrink the other one. There are other variations of this where you just alternate. So in one go round, you use the first feedback register and shift feedback register, and the second one you use the second one. Then for the third number, you use the first one, then you use the second one again. And then even if you do manage to get the whole of the bits, then they are kind of interspersed. But again, if you there are weaknesses to that because you know that system. So you know that they're both being used, and maybe you can go back and kind of reconstruct again. Now, there was a fairly famous algorithm published in 1993 by Siemens called FISH, Fibonacci Shrinking, again, because these linear feedback shrinkers are to do with polynomials and Fibonacci numbers. We won't worry too much about that now. Now, Ross Anderson wrote a paper where he showed that FISH could be broken, and this was using two LFSRs. It could be broken if you knew a few thousand bits of the plain text. So again, you've managed to crack it. You knew what message was being sent. That's how the Enigma code was broken, of course, because they knew what messages were being sent, weather signals and other things like that. And they're able to say, right, now we know what that is. So if we try to work backwards, then they can crack the code. That's one of the ways they did it. And so in that same paper, Anderson suggested that if the control bits had been the carry bits. Now, the carry bits is the number that comes out of the XOR. So when you XOR your taps together, if that bit had been used to decimate, to reduce the other LFSR, then it would have been harder to attack. So not using the least significant bit, but actually using the carry bit, which in itself is already XORs of some other bits. So you've now got this extra level of protection. And so therefore, Ocean 2 uses the carry bits of one LFSR to shrink the sequence of two other LFSRs. And Pike also used XOR for the least significant bits of the two LFSRs that were being used. So if you had LFSR 1, LFSR 2, when you took those two bits, you XOR them together, which means that you, again, when you see the random number that's being used, you don't know how did you get there. Did you get there because it was a 1 and a 0? Or did you get there because it was a 0 and a 1? And now suddenly you've got a whole bunch of complexity that you can't rebuild the initial state of the LFSR. Now, there's more, because this is why I said this was an interesting look at how difficult it is to write encryption. Now, there's another paper called The Statistical Weakness of Multiplexed Sequences. And in that, it was shown that there are some other inherent weaknesses of multiplexed LFSRs. And the paper suggests two things that need to be done. One is to decimate, shrink the output of the FSR, similar to what we talked about in that shrinking algorithm. And the other is to XOR the output. So this is another person who done some research and had some similar suggestions like Pike. And so I've taken all of those on board when I'm talking about the way that Ocean 2 functions. So how does Ocean 2 function? Ocean 2 uses three 128-bit LFSRs. So we had a 4-bit one, which of course was, you could trivially see the pattern. When you've got a 128-bit one, well, that's just going to produce a huge number. Now, with the taps at bit 128, 127, 126, and 121, that's one way that you can create a random sequence from a 128-bit number. There is another set of taps that could also be used. That will cycle through all 128 bits, which means it will give you this huge number of unique numbers before it gets back to its initial state. So in other words, in all terms of practicality, that's never going to happen. So you're guaranteed that you're getting a random sequence of numbers from this LFSR, and you, of course, to try to recreate what state you're in the middle of that FLSR, particularly using the other techniques I'm talking about, is pretty hard. So what I do is LFSR 3 is used to decimate the output, to drop bits, to say, no, we're not going to use it, which then confuses any cryptanalysis because it doesn't know why suddenly the pattern broke. So if the carry bit, not the least significant bit, of the carry bit of LFSR 3 is 1, then the least significant bit of LFSR 1 is ignored for 1 bit, while the least significant bit of LFSR 2 is ignored for 2 bits. And the reason I'm doing this is this means now that LFSR 1 and LFSR 2 are no longer in sequence, and they will change how they don't line up. And one of the problems you can have with cryptanalysis, of course, is when things are in sequence, when a pattern is created. Now, there is no pattern because they will start to diverge from their initial states, because sometimes one of them will drop 2 bits while the other one will only drop 1, which means you don't know where you were in the sequence. However, unlike the shrinking ones, it doesn't loop back round to wait for another 1 or a 0 to appear. It just does that as an arbitrary thing. If you get a 1, okay, obliterate some of those bits. And the output of the random number sequence is the least significant bit, that's the bit that gets shifted off, of the first one XORed with the least significant bit, the bit that gets shifted off, of the second one. And the fact that they are XORed means that, for example, if you had 1, 1, well, then you get a 0. And if you had 1 and a 0, you don't know whether you're getting a 0 because it's a 1 and a 0 or a 0 and a 1. So again, that means that there is not a direct correlation to the random numbers that you are using for the actual encryption. So even if you manage to break the encryption because you have a crib, you manage to decode it, you can't rebuild the state of those three LFSRs. And particularly number 3, you never know what that's going to be because it's never used in the output. And of course, we're using the carry bits for the decimation, not the least significant bits. Okay, so let's just show a practical example of that. You know, you've got 0 and a 1. Well, that gives you a 1 in your actual output. If it was a 1 and a 1, it gives you a 0. 1 and a 1, it gives you a 0. 0 and a 1 gives you a 1. 1 and a 1 and a 0. Now I've got 1 and a 0 gives you a 1. And we had a 1 here earlier that was from a 0 and a 1. So you don't know how come we got that 1. Was that, for what reason did we get that? And now we have a 0 here from a 1 and a 1. Okay, and then later on here, we might have a 0 and a 0 also gives you a 0. So you can't rebuild the state of these two shift registers by knowing this sequence, because they don't know. And you could try to rebuild a model of it where you take both cases, but then as you go for each bit, of course, that just amplifies out and you get many, 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 many versions. You don't know which one is being used. Now, each LFSR needs an initial state. We used 1111 in our example of our 4-bit one. Of course, you don't want to do that with a proper encryption. You need a key, a password that sets the state of those initial LFSRs, those initial registers, so that when they start generating their sequence of ones and zeros, you can always go back to that sequence for the decode. Or if you wanted to do another encode using the same password, using the same state, you could do that. So Ocean 2 initializes the LFSRs by taking a plaintext password, you know, my password 1, okay, and it generates a hash, a 256-bit hash of that using the SHA-256 algorithm, and then you take that hash and you use it to initialize a different LFSR, which is a temporary one, which I'm calling the LFSR captain, and that captain is then used to generate, in the traditional sense, ones and zeros, which are then fed into the three LFSRs, and then LFSR captain is discarded, so it's never used again. So you don't know what its state was, and you don't know how to get back to it. It's used and then discarded, and now you've now got your three LFSRs in an initial state, which is, in all intents and purposes, random, based on the password that was used, that then initialized another LFSR. That LFSR then generated a random sequence, which was then fed into those three LFSRs, which are then your initial statement, your initial state. And you can reproduce that every time. If you type in the same password, you get the same hash. If you get the same hash, you can generate the same state of the LFSR captain. Then the LFSR captain will then generate three lots of state data for the three other LFSRs, exactly the same each time, which is why we can then do encode and decode. Now, Ocean Tool also has the option to move along the sequence by n number of bytes before in starting the encode or the decode. This means that to encode a file, you need to supply a password and an optional offset. And then to decode it, you need the same password and the same additional offset. Why is that? Well, if you're going down, we'll do it in bytes. If you have 3 bytes down, and let's say you can get the number 42, then the number 101, the number 32. Okay, well, if you start in a different place down the sequence, you're not going to get those numbers, even if the password you've provided is the same, because you've changed the state and you've moved along. That means that Ocean 2 has the potential to be used as a one-time pad. Now, a one-time pad is an unbreakable method of encryption, which means that because you've got no way of knowing what the key was used, because it's only ever used once, then you can't ever keep looking at more and more data, keep analysing more and more stuff that this thing is creating to actually work out what the initial conditions are, because you only see it once. That's all the data you've got, and therefore it can't be broken. So every new mesh that's encrypted needs to start with a new offset, which should be 1 longer than the length of the previous encoded message. You get no overlapping. Okay, and one of the conditions of a successful one-time pad is that the key, which in this case will be the password and the offset, is never used twice. So if you can never use the same offset again, then you're never going to reuse that same sequence of numbers that are used for the encryption, and therefore it is completely unique. If you encrypt the same thing over and over and over again with the same password and the same offset, then you're going to use all that data you can have to mount some kind of crypto analysis, and maybe you can start to crack some of the initial messages. Now, performance. Now, the thing about LFS articles, this is not new. Everything I'm talking about here has been studied and created and analyzed by lots of other people before me. And the thing about LFSRs is that they like them in hardware. So if you're trying to do hardware encryption, you know, for example, you know, for satellite TV, they use LFSRs. For GSM encryption, so 2G encryption, using LFSRs, lots of places, because making that little register in hardware that can take two inputs, XOR them, add them onto the end of a shift register, that it can do that in hardware really, really quickly. And it's a very, very simple circuit for a hardware engineer to create, which means you can then pump out encryption in real time, like for TV signals, for signals on a GSM network, for example. Once you start using multiple registers, once you start using decimation, once you start doing other things, and the performance is going to drop. So of course, one of the things about modern day cryptography is not only just making something that's secure, it's also making something that is high performance. And Ocean 2 is not going to be as efficient as other encryption mechanisms when it comes to actually doing it from a hardware point of view and from a software, because it's doing more work. Now, you can find the source code written in C in my GitHub repository. I'll leave this link also in the description, github.com/GaryExplains/Ocean2. It's on a very permissive license. Go and knock yourself out and go and have a play with it. Now, if you're interested in the code, here's an example of how you can build this binary of a little encoder called Ocean2. You can use it. -P gives you the string as a password. If I've got a document, secretdesigns.doc, I can then encode that to secretdesigns.doc.oct for Ocean 2. Okay, and that is now the encrypted version, which will be, if you try to load that in Word, it certainly won't work because it's all been messed about with. And then if you do the reverse, if you just run it exactly the same again, but you've got the input is the .oct file and then the output is the .doc, because we're using XOR, and again, you should watch my video on the power of XOR, then the decode will happen. So you actually do the decode by just running the thing twice and taking the output of one and making it the input of the other. And also you can use the offset, like I said, so Ocean 2 minus P minus R, minus N 187172 means it will move 187,000 numbers down the sequence before it starts to do the encryption. If you don't provide both of those things, you can't decode it. So you need to know the password and the offset. And for doing the statistical analysis of how well the LFSRs work, there is a method of just pumping out random numbers. It just works on bytes at the moment. So 0255 could be easily changed if that's what you wanted to change that and submit a pull request. You can do that. So here I'm saying I want to start at, what's this? This is like 9 million, 9.8 million. And I'd like to pump out the numbers. I'd like 50 of them. So starting at that offset with this password, it will then give you 50 numbers. And you can use those numbers. Hopefully you'd want to print out more to do any kind of analysis on, to see if there are any, you know, kind of odd patterns that are being generated by the Ocean 2's LFSRs using the three 120-bit LFSRs as I described. Okay, so there you have it, Ocean 2, an amateur's attempt at writing an encryption algorithm, mainly for fun, just to have a look at some of the interesting challenges that there are involved in that. Lots of stuff borrowed from other people, some stuff going back decades, but I hope you enjoyed it. If you did enjoy it, please do give this video a thumbs up. Don't forget the source code is there over at GitHub. Go and have a play with it. Tell me what you think about it. Also, don't forget I have a newsletter. Go over to GaryExplains.com, type in your email address, no spam, just a newsletter. And don't forget to follow me on Twitter @GaryExplains. Okay, that's it. I'll see you in the next one.